Hi, I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is the Marketplace Weekend Podcast for the weekend of January 9th, 2015. Inheritance is a tricky word. For some people, it's money, sure. Maybe if we're lucky, a house. For others, it's a series of habits or something physical. A father's nose, a little dimple in the chin like your mother has. Even traits. You walk like her, talk like him. Smile with a smile of someone you never met. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is Marketplace Weekend, where the economy collides with real life. This week, what we inherit and what we pass down, from our individual checkbooks to the economy we leave behind, even the words of our idols, and whether everyone gets to read them. We want to read your thoughts on inheritance or on what you want to leave behind. Visit our website at marketplaceweekend.org or Marketplace's Facebook page, or tweet us. We're at Marketplace WKND. As we start our show on inheritance, think about this. Inheritance is not just personal. It's in the larger economy we leave behind. An economy that created 252,000 jobs last month, for example. Or what previous generations save for the next. We asked a few of you how you're saving for retirement and what you think about Social Security.
How do I plan to retire?
As soon as possible.
Oh, God, not very easily.
I have a 401k.
I have a 401k and I have an annuity.
I am in a union, and so I will have union benefits.
Well, I'm planning to work longer than I had originally planned.
My wife has a very good job.
I plan on retiring and traveling the world.
How about Social Security?
I haven't even given it a thought, honestly.
I'm not banking on it.
The economy is so uncertain, I'm just not planning to retire.
Happy. I'm planning to retire happy.
As Americans, we spend most of our careers paying into Social Security, with the promise that we'll get a little money from the country in our old age. But as baby boomers age and retire, the Social Security reserves are strained. Without any changes, Social Security's Disability Reserve Fund will run out next year, and its Retirement Trust Fund in 2034. Fully half of millennials don't think there'll be any money left for them in Social Security when they retire. That's according to a Pew poll. I asked Stephen Goss, the chief actuary of the Social Security Administration, when we need to make some changes.
So 2016, towards the end of the year, is the first point at which we have an issue that really needs to be dealt with. But what this really means is that the Congress will simply have to make some adjustments. And they've made many, many adjustments in the course of history of this program.
You're the most sanguine-sounding person on Congress that I think I have spoken to in, you know, a year or more.
There seems to be a broad understanding that the American people feel quite positively about Social Security. Everybody has relatives receiving benefits, and everybody, frankly, is really expecting in the future to receive benefits. The Congress well understands this, and the Congress has always acted in a timely fashion to make sure that we never hit a situation where benefits that have been scheduled simply cannot be paid.
You know, I'm going to dispute that with you a little bit. I'm 39, and when I talk to people who are my age and younger, I think they are skeptical that Social Security and what we understand it to be is going to look the same when I'm ready to retire or when my little brothers are ready to retire.
There is no question at all but that there will be some changes in Social Security over the time into the future. But keep in mind, for example, that for the Social Security program as a whole, combining the Old Age Survivors Insurance and the Disability Insurance programs together, we are looking at a situation that by 2033, we will have depleted these reserves. They're sort of like our savings account. But even if that were to happen with no action whatever from Congress, we would still have 77 cents of tax revenue coming in every year for every dollar of benefits that are currently scheduled on the law. So the challenge really for our Congress and the administrations of the future is to find a way to get these two flows back together. We have to either have a 23% reduction in the scheduled benefit levels or about a 35% increase and the level of revenue that's scheduled into the program, or some combination of the two. And as our dynamic political process tends to work, compromises happen, and we tend to have a mix of those two effects.
But the only thing that Congress has been able to compromise on, essentially, is, you know, naming post offices. Don't they need to move quickly to
ensure some sort of stability here?
Well, they do. And principally, the place where the action is needed is, of course, for that disability insurance trust fund.
Now, so are they going to do it?
Well, I think we can be about as confident that Congress will act on that as we can be confident about anything.
Mr. Goss, do you have kids?
I do indeed. I have two daughters.
What is Social Security going to look like for them?
My expectation is that Social Security will likely look very, very much like we see it today. We have worked with a lot of different members of Congress and commissions. Most recently in 2010, you'll probably remember the Simpson-Bowles Commission.
Oh, yes.
There was also the Bipartisan Policy Center's Rivlin-Domenici Commission. Both of those commissions came up with package deals to put Social Security back on good financial footing for the indefinite future.
Deals that did not get done.
Well, they have not gotten enacted yet. But they do provide sort of a view of the kinds of things that many people who've looked deeply into the program are considering. And you'll not be surprised, they incorporated a combination of many different items, I think all of which are something like some further increase in the normal retirement age, some increase in revenue by increasing our taxable base. There are lots and lots of moving parts that can be affected here.
I hear you, and yet I think if you are someone who receives a retirement check from Social Security or a disability check, and you hear commission and another commission, and Congress has proposals and they need to act, I'd get frustrated. What do you say to people who want to know what's going to happen to my check?
I would suggest that there is really no reason for people to be concerned or to be worried about the future of Social Security. And one other observation that seems to be sort of important is that each new generation that comes forth may have slightly different views about what it wants from Social Security and really from all of our federal programs. And is it not perhaps a good thing that we do have the need to be able to reconsider some aspects of a program like this to make sure that it evolves in a way that each succeeding generation most would like?
Stephen Goss is the Chief Actuary of the Social Security Administration. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Lizzie, a pleasure.
You're listening to Marketplace Weekend. We wanted to put the question of Social Security in a broader context. How should it figure into our planning, individually and as a country, when we think about retiring? And what kind of economy will inherit? Alicia Minnell is the director of the Center for Retirement Research at Boston College. I asked her about what Steve Goss from the Social Security Administration told me.
I think that Steve Goss, the chief actuary, told you the right story, and that is that we have revenues to pay 75% of what we have today. And those revenues are going to keep coming in year after year after year, and nobody has talked about cutting back on the payroll tax. I think the reason I'm so passionate about maintaining Social Security is that it's really the backbone of our retirement system, and the rest of the body is not very well. For people who in the private sector are lucky enough to have 401k plans, the most recent survey by the Federal Reserve shows that for a household approaching retirement, if you include their IRA balances as well as their 401k balances, the median amount is $111,000. When you start doling that out on a monthly basis, it's really trivial. Then you look at the other half of the working population in the private sector. They are not covered by anything.
So what kind of an inheritance do you think that leaves for future generations?
I mean, I think, first of all, we've got to fix this. And we can fix this. It requires a two-pronged attack. People need to work longer, not until their 90s, but they need to work closer to 70. If you claim your Social Security benefit at 70 instead of 62, your monthly benefit is 76% higher.
Wow.
And this is terrific income, too, because it's inflation indexed and it goes on for as long as you live. The second component is to preserve Social Security. We can make 401k plans work a lot better. We need to make them automatic enrollment,
automatic increase in whatever default rate, then we need to figure out some way to cover the uncovered.
You know, this is not sexy stuff.
No, it's not. I wish I could make it sexier. It's just not.
How do you get it to, you know, poke through most people's consciousness?
The working longer part, which is really on the individual side. That's something that most people can control. The other really requires legislation. And so Congress at some point is going to have to look up and notice that their parents or their colleagues are not retiring on adequate money, and that something needs to be done.
Doing that, I think, also requires a fundamental shift in the way our economy rewards things. After all, we have a heavily consumer spending-driven economy. That doesn't align with a lot of long-term planning.
I think that's absolutely correct. The key thing for individuals is to establish a level of spending that's sustainable. So people really have to think whether they need a bigger house or a more expensive car.
And yet so much of our economy is powered by debt.
For many people, especially middle-income people, their house is their largest asset. And yet people are so reluctant to tap home equity in retirement. And then I think there's also this feeling like you should leave something to your kids. And I think we need to tell people that these are really their assets, their kids will be fine, and they should use them when they retire.
I think about the initial promises of Social Security and the sort of social compact that that embraces. What sort of social compact do you think we are leaving for future generations?
We've known that we've had this shortfall in Social Security for the last almost 25 years. We should have raised taxes in the early 90s. And that would have meant that some of the deficit would have been made up by the baby boom generation, who would have been paying higher taxes. This whole cohort has escaped paying the higher taxes that they should have for their benefits and has put the burden on today's and tomorrow's workers. So, I mean, that, in my view, is an unfair shift and should not have occurred.
Alicia Monell is the director for the Center of Retirement Research at Boston College. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, my pleasure.
There's more Marketplace Weekend just ahead. Inheritance is not, of course, always about material things. Around the country this week, lots of people were inheriting governments, towns, and cities. We called up three brand new mayors to find out what it's like to step into office and figure out what to do with what's been left to you. I've got Louise Carter King from Gillette, Wyoming, Biff Traber from Corvallis, Oregon, and Dennis Mock from Dalton, Georgia. Hello to you, and I guess say hi, everybody.
Hello.
Hi, guys. Hello.
Nice to hear from you all.
I have you all on here together because you are all new mayors, even though you've got some degree of experience among the three of you in the cities that you are now responsible for. I guess I'm curious, what did you walk into? Louise Carter King, you're a brand new mayor. What'd you walk into in your first day?
Well, we're right in the middle of a boom here, so it's a busy place. Right now we're working on a $275 million water project to get more water here. So we're busy growing, building roads, and just keeping up with the growth.
Dennis Mock, I know that one of the things that is interesting to you is making Dalton more of a college town with Dalton State College growing. How do you do that, and what did you inherit?
I've inherited a very good situation. Our city's financially sound, and our college is growing by leaps and bounds, and we're actually getting a technical college that's going to locate a campus here. I would like to comment on the Wyoming need for water. We have plenty here. If we can pipe it to you.
Okay.
I want to bring in Biff Traber because you've got Oregon State in Corvallis. Any words of advice for growing a college town?
Financially, we're in reasonable shape, but one of the major areas we're dealing with right now is Oregon State University and its growth. It has grown from about 15,000 students to 25,000 students on the campus here in about the past 10 to 14 years. And that has led to a range of town and gown problems. The impacts have to do with where do students live, when they live in the community, what kind of impact they have on the near-campus community. Mm. But the good news is we're working it. Sometimes it can be contentious, but it is being worked together rather than fought over.
Being a mayor and running a city seems to me that a lot of this is as much about office culture and working with people and understanding the people in your city. How do you do that?
Well, I'll go first. Here we're growing so rapidly that we have to work with the other entities, which includes the county, the school districts, the college, the hospital, and we all pitch in together to build our college and to build different things. And I think that's one thing that we know we're all serving the same people, so why not work together? And we've done that well.
Same here. I mean, it's a community from inside out, and we have to collaborate and work with all the facets of it. And one of the benefits of being a smaller town is we go to church together with county people, and we go to our kids go to schools with county people, and you know, we're all pretty much family here, and we have to get along, and it's definitely in the best interest of our community to do that.
You know, the theme of our show this week is inheritance, and we talked a little bit about what you all walked into. I guess I'm curious, what do you want to leave? What's the legacy you'd like to leave in the different places where you are?
Well, this is Biff. I think when I was describing what I walked into, it had to do with the work tasks or major focuses going forward. Part of what I'd like to leave when we're done here is an updated vision and plan for how the city's going to grow and how the different entities are going to work together. It's time for us to do that as a city, and that's a major multi-year project that the community has to go through.
And I guess from my perspective, I'd like to see the college that we have here grow as well. And we're doing that with an activity center and an educational center and more dorms. And I guess I'd like to say I'd like to leave the city better than when I got here.
Okay. And I'd like to see college growth here, of course, but I'd also like to see some economic development and diversification, which we have lacked and continue to lack a little bit of. We're known as the carpet capital of the world, and that's been our focus for years. And it's, you know, with the downturn in the economy, that's been probably the biggest thing that's drawn us down. As the housing industry goes, we go.
Mm. I was going to echo Dennis's comment about the critical importance in Corvallis of economic development. Where we have, for 10 years, had our major employer be shrinking with technology employer HP, and we're continuing to work to start new businesses come out of the campus that we are able to build on and grow here.
What do people get wrong about your towns and cities and about what makes them different or special?
I think one thing that people get wrong about ours is that we're kind of backwards or something, but we're on, I think, here in Wyoming, we're on the cutting edge of just about anywhere else. And, you know, some people are just surprised. Oh, well, you know, you all have, you know, we mine the coal for the electricity for the nation, but we also use it.
And same here. I think people have a misconception of us being in the South. We're probably a little backward and all. But in fact, my grandfather, when he visited here years ago for the first time, was really surprised that all our houses were not built up on sticks. And it was funny. You know, he looked around and he said, man, this is really a progressive town.
Well, I want to thank all of you for talking with me. Dennis Mock, Biff Traber, and Louise Carter King, and congratulations and good luck.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I appreciate it. And it was nice talking to you, Dennis and Biff.
Oh, I've enjoyed this. This was a lot of fun.
Maybe we can compare notes sometime.
All right.
All right. Well, we'll make that happen.
You're listening to Marketplace Weekend. Every day, you and I interact with the world of tech.
Today, we're going to be showing our friends the basics of technology. This is Tech in Real Life.
Ben Johnson is the host of Marketplace Tech and our guide to tech in real life. Hi, Ben.
Hi, Lizzie.
So today we're going to talk about death and how we handle that on the internet. What happens now with all of the sort of digital accoutrement when someone dies?
A lot of things happen with all of this stuff. Facebook pages come down or actually become kind of memorials to the person who died. Twitter accounts can get canceled or just go silent. Companies are starting to allow relatives access to passwords to these social accounts. Others will actually terminate an account after someone dies. This is, of course, all a lot easier, just like a lot of other kinds of inheritance, if the person who dies has actually thought ahead to put instructions into their will, for instance.
I'm thinking about two friends of mine, reporters who were killed on assignment.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this was an open question when that happened, how the survivors approached that. Is it becoming more common for people to leave instructions?
I think it is. Now, this is like a really interesting question generally, because the answer is always changing in terms of what we do with our data and how much data we're putting out there, right? A few years ago, it might have been a MySpace page or a Friendster account, something like that. Now it can be a ton of different things. It could be your payment history on Venmo. It could be texts. Earlier this year, I interviewed a writer named Leslie Horn about accessing voicemails that were in actually her possession, but were left by her dad who had died unexpectedly. Mm. And the amount of data generally that we're leaving behind is really growing by staggering amounts. I guess some people have made the joke, yes, can you clear my history after I pass away? But there are very serious services and practices that are starting to pop up in this area.
Like what?
Well, there's a bunch of different ones. Cirrus is one, and Chronicle of Life. These are all services that deal with this sort of thing. I actually had a really interesting thing happen to me recently when I was tweaking my Google account settings.
Okay.
So I was going into my safety settings, my security settings, things like that. And Google actually has a part of your Gmail account that you can change so that the way that they phrased it was when your account is dormant for a certain period of time. Then they actually ask you who all your data should go to, who your passwords, everything that you've stored on their storage service drive, all of that stuff should go to. And that was like this really interesting pause for me being like, oh, who should I put in charge of this?
What did you decide? Is it going to your wife?
It's going to my wife. I decided that she was probably the best person to deal with this stuff. But it's a really interesting question, right?
It's an interesting question. It's also one that I can imagine would get very messy. I mean,
it could.
The physical belongings of someone who passes away are often disputed. And this feels like there's another layer of complexity once you introduce digital data.
Absolutely. In terms of who owns the data, the social network, the user or the user's surviving relatives, it can really depend on where you live, both online and actually in person. So different companies have different policies about data. Different states are starting to put forth legislation about data ownership in case of a death. So one example, last year, Delaware passed a law making digital assets part of the general estate and applying the same instructions. But still, in most states, though, this should be addressed probably more directly in the will, at least for now.
When we look forward, where is all of this headed?
Well, it's hard to tell, but it's a growing issue. More and more, we're actually kind of defined by our data, right, that we put online. And also, our data has more value than it used to. Imagine someday a person's accounts and digital data might actually be almost like an annuity or a savings account that you could actually then sell. It's gathered value over time, and it could be like a piece of property that you might sell to a company that might use that data.
That's incredibly difficult to wrap my mind around.
It's a very strange idea, right? But in some ways, you can imagine that it could actually be a really wonderful thing for the people that live on after you pass away to actually be able to give them something of value in that data. Maybe that value is they get to look at all the emails that you've sent over the years, or maybe that is actually selling that information. I don't know if you've been watching this TV show Black Mirror that is now on Netflix.
Right.
This is a British TV show that's just become available on Netflix, and there's actually a really interesting episode. This is, of course, all fictional, but it's an episode about someone who's partner dies, and when he dies, there's a service that actually takes all of his social data, all of the videos he's recorded over the years, all of his tweets, all of his Facebook posts, and turns that into a kind of artificial intelligence that she can interact with. Now, this episode, it sounds really strange, but there are actual services that have started experimenting with this, this idea that they would take a look at all of the social data you created while you were alive and actually mimic some of your own musings online and keep posting to your social accounts after you've passed away. So that's a real thing that's already happening.
Ben Johnson is the host of Marketplace Tech and our guide to tech in real life. Thank you so much, Ben.
Thank you, Lizzie.
We just heard about how our online identities can live on after death. But what about public legacies, people whose lives and work leave an inheritance of sorts for more than just their families? If you go to the movies this weekend, you may witness part of Martin Luther King Jr.'s legacy in the movie Selma, which went into wide release on Friday. But it's only part. David Garrow wrote the King biography Bearing the Cross, which won a Pulitzer Prize. I asked him about the version of Dr. King that moviegoers will see in Selma.
In the Selma movie, the Dr. King character whom they're going to see is a rough approximation of the real Dr. King. The words that the Dr. King character speaks in the Selma movie are a fake text. They're not the real Dr. King.
And why are the words that the King character speaks different?
The Dr. King character whom we have in the Selma movie is a substitute Dr. King who's forced to utter fictional words, not Dr. King's own words, because of the King children's insistence that if you're going to present the real Dr. King and the real words of Dr. King, you have to pay them for permission.
You could make the argument that the children do deserve to benefit financially from their father's legacy.
Well, Mrs. King's attitude, she clearly had the attitude, the understandable attitude, that she and her children were owed something by somebody as a result of him having been taken from them and they're not being left with much of anything at that time.
In your research, did you come across anything that sort of changed your idea of what the King inheritance is?
I think the most powerful thing is just what a tremendously powerful, resolute, faith grounding Dr. King had. I don't think one can really understand the private Dr. King without listening to all of these scores, really hundreds of sermons. People can appreciate that he was a, you know, quote-unquote civil rights leader from what's easily accessible nowadays, but you can't appreciate how profound and deep a faith he was operating from without being able to experience those sermons in an audio format.
So what do you think that leaves us with?
It leaves us with a much lesser Dr. King, a fundamentally incomplete Dr. King, compared to the reality that I've experienced having the advantages and access that I had back during the 1980s.
What did you learn in your research about what he wanted for his legacy and how public it should be?
During the last several years of Dr. King's life, his organization, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, actually mounted a radio program using these sermon tapes where they, you know, using the technology of the 1960s, you know, were mailing the tapes to different radio stations across the country. And that was their way at the time of getting his word out, you know, at a time when, you know, you didn't have the internet. But that's really the best evidence of, you know, wanting to get the word out rather than making a profit off of it.
What do you think this tension changes what we perceive or what we get from his legacy?
I think because of his children's behavior, Dr. King suffers from a shrunken legacy, a less visible legacy, than would be the case if his family's attitude instead was that they wanted to maximize the world's understanding of Dr. King rather than maximize their own monetary reward.
Will you go to see Selma?
Probably not. I don't like the idea of, you know, paying, you know, $10 or whatever it would be to see the fake Dr. King rather than a real Dr. King.
David Garrow is the author of Bearing the Cross, the Pulitzer Prize-winning biography of Martin Luther King. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to Marketplace Weekend, where the economy collides with real life. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. As we know from everyone from Jane Austen to Henry James, an inheritance can do unexpected things to a family. In real life, Carrie Reef is counting down the days to when she can access the inheritance her parents left her. Reef has been waiting quite a while. She describes the day she found out what plans her parents had put in place.
I didn't find out until the airplane ride home from the funeral that my third was put in a trust. I read that my inheritance was accessible to me when I turned 55. At the time, I was 48. And I, at that moment, I felt like I was 12 years old. I'm not sure whose idea this was. Was it my mom's? Was it my siblings? I think I would have handled it better if I had been in on the conversation from the beginning. I didn't get the respect that I probably thought an adult should get. The issue was I had high school and college age kids that really needed my help. I had one that was trying to get a loan. There was another one that wanted to buy a used car, and I just wasn't in a position to do that. And the frustrating thing is that choice was taken away from me. I could have really helped my kids at that moment. My brother and sister are very close, and I don't think they're as sympathetic to my situation because they already have access to their funds. We were actually a very tight family. My parents were very active in their grandkids' lives, and we had, you know, we celebrated all of the birthdays and anniversaries, and we were just a really close family. And it's not unusual for things to fall apart after the parents die. But this took it a step further. For a while, my brother and I were texting each other, and we aren't even doing that now. Because of the strain in the relationship, I just don't see it being repaired. Money does funny things to people, and it will change relationships drastically. I'm now almost 55. I actually have an app on my phone that I've had for quite a while, and it's counting down the days until my 55th birthday. And as we're talking today, I have 90 days, 12 hours, and 19 minutes left. But who's counting? And I almost wonder if this deadline is a chance to close one chapter and start something brand new.
We just heard a story about how money can strain family relationships, especially when plans aren't clear to everyone. Now we turn to Chris Long, a certified financial planner, to find out what to do when dealing with inherited money or money you want to pass on. But first, we ask listeners and members of our community, what do you inherit? What do you wish you inherited? And what did you do?
Am I inheriting anything? Not that I know of.
No.
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 No. No jewelry. No. No.
No.
No.
No.
Absolutely nothing.
Inherit? No.
Why would I be? They worked as hard as they could.
They shouldn't have to leave me anything.
You know, I really don't know. We don't talk about that.
I might get the house that my parents live in. I don't count on it, though. So if that happens, that'd be great. But if not, I get it.
Possibly. I mean, I have an aunt who has a house, and she has no children. So it's possible, but there's no guarantee.
Yes.
Debt? I'm inheriting debt, probably.
I'm inheriting money and land from my parents.
I mean, likely small things and jewelry will be what I get from my grandma, but that's about it. We've got a large family, so anything they have will be spread out amongst a lot of people.
I mean, my parents and my grandparents are very financially savvy, and they taught me from a young age how to manage my finances, and you know, it was always anticipated for me to use that money to buy a house, so that's what I'll be using it for. It's not just going to immediately get burned on booze and women.
I'm going to try to give my family or children money.
There is a one saying, like, if you are giving a good culture, good education, you don't need to give money and house, right?
I keep telling my parents, you know, you need to sell everything before, just spend it all. You deserve it, spend it all.
You deserve it, spend it all. Chris Long, certified financial planner, thank you for joining us. If somebody comes to you, are you ever going to say, hey, you deserve it, spend it all?
In a lot of circumstances, I kind of agree with what the last person said.
Really?
It's hard to spend every single penny, though, because you don't know exactly when your end is going to be. But I think that people need to focus first on themselves versus worrying about leaving a potential inheritance.
This is, I guess, the financial version of, like, you know, put your oxygen mask on first before turning to your child?
Correct. Yeah. The idea is that, let's say you have medical expenses towards the end of life that you need to take care of. But I do see that, you know, you've earned that money, you've saved for it all your life. There's nothing wrong with using it for the purposes you feel are the most important.
We also heard another voice in there of someone saying, you know, we don't talk about it. I wonder where inheritance, if we're talking money or habits or debt or any of that stuff, where does it rank in what people are willing to have conversations about?
It ranks pretty low because it combines two topics that people don't want to talk about. One, their death, and two, money.
Is it smart overall to leave money, do you think?
Well, you know, I that's a really interesting question. I think it really depends on the circumstances. So for somebody had said in the clip about, you know, they're going to use the money to buy a house. So often leaving an inheritance can really help the person that's receiving it achieve a life goal that is really positive. On the flip side, you know, let's say somebody had some type of problems with, you know, substance abuse or spent money unwisely, you know, kind of leaving them an inheritance might make their lives worse. So it really depends on the circumstance.
There are also some dollar questions in here. What's the limit to what you can give as an inheritance and not pay tax?
The federal limit is about $5.4 million. So very few people are going to bump up against that.
So pretty generous there.
It's fairly generous.
And in terms of gifts?
So gifts, it's a little bit tricky. You can give anyone $14,000 a year. I think that's of the 2015, without filing a gift tax return. If you were to give somebody more than that, you don't have to pay tax right away. It just reduces that $5 million. It's like you've given away some of your exemption. So if you gave somebody $100,000, the amount above that $14,000 would just come off that $5.4 million that you can leave.
We heard a few people talk about inheriting debt. I mean, that's certainly the darker side of this. What happens then?
So, and I think there's a little bit of a misperception about the inheritance of debt. Usually when somebody dies, their debts die with them. But if their estate, so let's say you have a house with, and you die and you have a mortgage on that house, the executor of your estate is still responsible for paying that mortgage off with the proceeds from the house sale. There is one rare instance that I have read about where there are a few states that do have laws that say that relatives can be responsible for somebody's debt. And there was one case in Pennsylvania where I think a son was held responsible for his parents' debts when they died. But I think that's a very, very rare instance.
On a really practical level, how do you do this? I mean, are we talking about goes into a checking account? What's the smartest way to give away your money?
I think for something like a house that might have gone up in value, or if you had a stock portfolio that went up in value, it's much better to leave it to your heirs versus giving it to them while you're still alive. So, and there's something called a step up in basis. So let's say I had a house and I paid $10,000 for the house, and now it's worth $1 million. If I gave that to someone before I died, they would owe tax on the difference between the price I paid for it and what it's worth now. So that's $990,000. If I left it to that person as part of my inheritance, their basis or what they would owe tax on starts at $1 million. So they would owe no – if they sold the house the next day, they'd owe nothing. So it's much better to leave things that are going to be appreciated assets to somebody in your will versus giving it to them. I see often a lot of times parents will give a house to their children while they're still alive, and that's usually a bad move financially.
Chris Long is a certified financial planner. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Sure. Thank you.
Next week, we're exploring gaps in our economy and in our lives. We want to know, have you ever had a gap? A year or more, maybe you needed money before school, or you were unemployed for a while. Tell us about that financial gap in time and how it affected your life. You can write us at marketplaceweekend.org or on Facebook or Twitter. We're at Marketplace WKND. You're listening to Marketplace Weekend. Among the few things I have from my Grandma Elsie, besides reddish hair, is a $2 bill. It's dated 1976, and she gave it to my mother when I was a baby. There's a decent chance you might have a $2 bill stashed away somewhere. In a drawer, a box of keepsakes, maybe even in your wallet. They're often passed down from loved ones, like my grandmother, and these bills hold a special place in our collective hearts. They're also the subject of this week's installment of the Marketplace series, I've Always Wondered.
If you wonder...
By asking 1,000 questions to get one answer, by brain work and blade work.
Our question today comes from Patricia Anita Young of Minneapolis, Minnesota.
My question is about $2 bills. I like to call them $2 bills. Are they ever going to be worth anything? And is it worth hoarding them? Are they going to stop printing them? Are they going to print more?
Marketplace's Tommy Andres finds out why the two became the rarest denomination.
The nickname for the two is a Tom, thanks to Thomas Jefferson, who adorns them. And the nation's foremost expert on Toms might just be this guy.
My name is John Bernardo, and I'm the producer and director of the $2 Bill documentary, which is currently in post-production.
John has done hours and hours of research and interviewed dozens of people for his film, and he says the story of the two starts with America's first printing of federal paper money.
This is 1862.
The two was in that first printing, but it took a while for paper money to catch on. And then came the Great Depression.
This was a time when our country did not have much wealth, and a lot of things cost less than a dollar. So the $2 bill really didn't have much of a practical use.
The economy recovered, of course, and for some strange reason, the two slowly became the perfect note for nefarious purposes.
Politicians used to be known for bribing people for votes, and they would bribe them with a $2 bill. $2 bills is the standard bet at a racetrack. So if you won, you might get a bunch of $2 back, and that would show you've been gambling. Prostitution back in the day, it was $2 for a trick.
Hey, big boy.
So if you were spending $2 bills, it might get you into some trouble with your wife.
Tom got kind of a dirty rep. And over the years, as inflation brought the value of the single and the two closer and closer together, folks didn't see much use for poor old Tom.
So by 1966, they decided we don't need a $2 bill anymore. There's not enough of them being used. So they stopped making it.
10 years, no Toms. But here's the thing. The two made a lot of sense.
It's actually more cost efficient to print twos instead of ones.
Today, for example, it costs about 5 cents to make a dollar, and it costs the same to make a two.
You can print half as many twos and get the same dollar amount.
So in 1976, the Treasury decided it would try again. It would print a special bill for the bicentennial with a big picture of the signing of the Declaration of Independence on the back.
They made 400 million of them. They made half as many ones. They saved themselves a lot of money.
And the bicentennial bills turned out really nice. A little too nice, in fact.
It was so beautiful that people just said, this is a collector's item, this is worth something more than $2, I'm going to save this.
And much to the government's chagrin, people put them in drawers and keepsake boxes and passed them down to loved ones. And again,
it never caught on.
So how rare are twos? Well, that depends on what you consider rare.
I think it's 1.2 billion that are out there.
And they are still being printed.
75 million notes in the last year and a half.
Of course, 3 billion ones were produced in that same amount of time. In fact, out of the $1.25 trillion worth of coins and bills in circulation right now, less than 0.1% are Toms.
It's rare compared to other notes. But it's not rare in its own right.
The fact is, you can get twos at almost any bank. You just have to ask. And there's a small subculture of $2 ambassadors out there who do just that. Folks who get stacks of bills at a time and spend them, trying to keep the two alive. Patricia, our question asker, actually says she's one of them.
Because I give them out and they act so excited, like, what is this? My beautician loves them.
That's why John says the real value isn't in collecting Toms, it's in spending them.
They always get a smile, they always get a conversation, they always get something more than just what happens when you spend a one, a five, or a ten. It's a way to get remembered, it's a way to stand out.
I'm Tommy Andres for Marketplace Weekend.
John Bernardo's film, The $2 Bill Documentary, is expected to come out this summer. We have another story of inheritance now, and it's from one of our listeners, Amelia Rosenman. She wrote us about inheriting frugality, then taking that lesson and making it her own.
The July I was 25, I visited a friend I'd made in college at her childhood home in Vermont. They lived in an old farmhouse with foraged blueberries spilling out the fridge and a half-wild, half-tended garden that got drenched in rain twice a day. Every evening around 5, they would take out 2 or 3 nice cheeses, maybe a goat triple cream, an aged cheddar, a Ronsal, and we'd all sit around enjoying a pre-dinner cheese course. This floored me. From my parents, I had inherited unequivocal thrift when it came to groceries. We did our shopping at Safeway, we ate pasta 3 days a week, and the cereals in the cupboard depended on the latest 2-for-1 deal. My family spent money on other luxuries, museum memberships, orthodontics, trips to Disneyland, but about food, we were always practical. It makes sense to me. There's nothing inexpensive about feeding a family of 5. But there in that Vermont farmhouse, I had a revelation. Some people spend money on good cheese. And it's really good. Ever since then, I linger for longer over cheeses named after birds and mountains and faraway lands. And once in a while, I splurge.
That was listener Amelia Rosenman. She wrote in to tell us her story. Visit our website, marketplaceweekend.org, to tell us yours. And that's our show for this week. Marketplace Weekend is produced by Jenny Ament and Eliza Mills, with help this week from Jody Avergan. Dan Simatovich is our senior producer, and Jeff Peters is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Deborah Clark is Marketplace's executive producer and vice president. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Next week, we'll talk about gaps, wealth, income, understanding among and between people. We'll see you then. Thanks for listening. This is APM.